Ну что ж, хорошо. На моих часах половина второго, так давайте начнем. Да? Здравствуйте.
It is 1:30 in my clock. My name is Mariusz Ostrowski. I'm from Poland. I work in Microsoft United Communication Architect. As you can hear, I can speak Russian, but not my Russian is not so good. Well, I lived 25 years ago in Moscow. I have a little bit of Russian left, but if I will try to make a presentation in Russian, you will not understand me. Therefore, I would like to apologize and I will switch to English. An interpreter will translate me into Russian language to those of you who want to listen to me in Russian. And if you will have any question, please ask me in Russian and then I will try to answer you. Well, Russian or English, we'll see. All right?
To English, I guess. I'm really glad to be here in Moscow. I'm very glad to be part of the team that delivers the link track of TechEd Russia conference. I'll be delivering the session on video and conferencing. I also have another one later today at 6 p.m. During which I will be discussing Russian пропускные способности для Link 2013. And my colleague Nikolai, he also have a session at 3, I believe, on voice features. So we have three more link sessions today for you. And please welcome and attend that sessions if you want to learn more on link, and especially link voice and video. So this session is about video conferencing and collaboration. We'll actually focus primarily around the video because this is the very hot topic in Link 2013. We'll focus on user-facing features, but we'll also discuss some design aspects. I split this session in two parts. The first part is on video, because that's very hot, that's very important, and the second is on collaboration. So let's discuss the first part, and I realize that some of you might not be familiar with Link 2013 yet. We did demo during one of the sessions. Some of you might have seen it. Some of you might even install the Link 2013 preview version, but still, it's still fairly unknown. So I'm gonna walk you very slowly through the, what we call the user experience, because it's also very important to understand the user experience that we are providing with Link 2013 in terms of video. So I'm gonna go through three scenarios. The first scenario will be very simple. Second is more sophisticated, and the third one will be the most complex one. And you will see how the video in Link 2013 works from simple peer-to-peer up to the most complex scenarios. And I'm doing that for the reason because I want to highlight some new users facing features that we introduced. So for the peer-to-peer video calls, the very first thing that I would like to highlight that we start with is, can we actually make a video call to that person? Can a link help us to figure out if we can make the video call to that person? So if I'm looking at the Link 2013 client, you might notice, rather these of you who are sitting in the front rows, unfortunately from last rows, you might have a hard time seeing this little thing here called video. That is an indicator to me that this gentleman, Blake Carpenter, is able to have a video call with me. Some other people here, they don't have these indicators. So I might have a video call with them, but this guy is definitely ready for a video call. So let's try to make a video call to him. How do I do it? We made it really simple. With Link 2013 client, as soon as you hover the mouse over the user in your contact list, you'll get different buttons. One of the buttons looks like a video camera. That's your video call. As simple as that. One click for the video. Now, here is the interesting part. When you are placing the video call, initially, you will be presented even before the video starts. This is not the video call yet. This is just setting up call. You will be presented with the image that the person that you are calling to placed into link system as a representation of him or her in the system. So normally you would rather see a single image of the single person, but if you want to, you might also include some other nice picture photo there that represents you. So it gives us a kind of a like pre-video experience of video. You already know how that person might look like when you actually see him on a video. Also, what you notice here is this little thing called video preview. For me, when I'm placing the call, it's quite important if I'm going to be seen properly. You know, funny things like if my hair is okay, but also if I'm sitting in the right place in front of the camera. Because if I don't, if I move too far to the right from the camera, camera might not see me because the angle of the camera is not wide enough, right? So that's why these little things that we included in Link 2013, like preview of me, preview of the person that I'm calling, even before the video call connects. These are little things that users told us that they are important. Then when I'm receiving a call, like if I'm on the other end of the video call, I'm instantly getting the indication that someone is calling me on video. See this little sign, like a camera, like a film camera? This is indication for me that this is the video call. Very easy to recognize, oh, someone is calling me on a video. So I can either just click it and accept and have a video experience instantly, or if I want to, I can decide. I'm fully in a control on deciding what do I want to do. Do I want to have a video call, or maybe I'd rather want audio only call, or maybe I don't want to have a call at all. Maybe I want to send a call to the voicemail because I'm not right now in a mood for having a video call with that other person. So one of the very important things in video in 2013 is the power of control over the video experience that we are giving to the users. They are not forced for it, they can control it. That's why very, very key important distinguishing factors for Link 2013 video from other competitive solutions, if you wish. A power of control. Now, here's the video. When you get the video window, it pops up instantly. You still might see your own preview. You can hide it if you don't want to, of course. And then one very first that you would notice is kind of like a size of the video. The size of the video, first of all, is about the resolution, aspect of the resolution. The aspect of resolution is 16:9, so it's a typical resolution these days that we use in television or even for the PC screens, right? So it's not a square box anymore, right? It's a HD-like type of experience. Now, it doesn't mean yet that the call is HD, because typically, at the very beginning, we pick up the kind of window that doesn't occupy the whole screen. Typical screen of the PCs these days is roughly around HD, 2 full HD resolution. Typical screen is roughly like 1600 by 1200 for a desktop computer, and for the laptops it's slightly less. So we don't want to occupy the whole space on the screen. We choose slightly less, and then we provide this experience which is HD-like. Now, if the user decides, he can enlarge the window or squeeze the window, and the video resolution will follow that. So if you kind of like start enlarging the window or even make it full screen, you may end up with a much higher resolution, so the image will stay perfect even if you enlarge it. Actually, before I go into details, I just wanted to highlight that we can go up to full high definition resolution, 1080p, provided certain conditions are met, and we are going to discuss these conditions. All right, slightly more sophisticated scenario now, the video conference, but the ad hoc conference. So think we are still in a point-to-point call. We are still talking one-to-one. I'm talking to that gentleman called Brian Wilson, and then we find out that we need another third person in our conversation, because that person, let's say Christina, she has some valuable information, but you would like to ask her for that. So obviously, as you know, the only thing that we need to do is just to drag and drop her into the conference. Now, here is the little magic that's happening. After a couple of seconds, 1, 2, 3 seconds, sometimes more, sometimes less, depending on your luck, let's put it that way, you'll get experience like that. This is what we call multi-view gallery. This is when video streams stop flowing link client to link client, but they start flowing towards what we call AD, audio video MCU, multipoint control unit. So basically link video bridge, you could say. Now, what's interesting about this experience, because I'll be describing what's happening behind the scenes later on, but what's happening about that user experience is you might notice that, of course, we now have Christina. We also have that gentleman, I guess his name was Brad or whatever, and, well, kind of me in experience, right? A preview of myself. But the size of the or experience of the video became slightly different. Instead of one big video window, we now see kind of like a gallery. That's why we call it multi-view gallery. And multi-view because we have multiple users in this experience. You can actually have up to 5 active users in that experience, and they are basically selected based on their being active. Now, in a small ad hoc conference, honestly, you'll not see most often this type of experience, because small ad hoc conferences usually end up at 3-4 persons, no more. We'll get into more formal scheduled scenarios later on, but this is the typical scenario for the ad hoc video conference in Link. Now, what's interesting also about that user experience is you can, of course, add a collaboration to that, right? You can add a collaboration at any time if you want to share some document that you should discuss. Now, one thing it's important to notice in that user experience is that whole video moved up. There are certain reasons why we did that. There are certain reasons why we moved it up and not to the right or to the left. Well, actually, right or left, you're right. The reason is very simple. We humans tend to notice much easier what's happening slightly above than on the right or left. The way our eyes work, the way we have our viewing angle is we notice better something that is slightly above or below than something that's happening on the right and left. The reason I'm telling you that is because we made significant investment on designing that user experience. And for some people who have experience with some other type of clients, that might look strange at the very beginning. Because typically some other clients, and also Link 2010 clients, the video was in some different place. It was on the left side by default, right? Not above. That's why we did it, because we invested in certain program of discussing with people how they perceive video experience, and we discuss also with the scientists that know how humans basically see each other, right? This is very well thought of process that led us to that kind of experience. And I'm giving you, because I'm really proud of it, because we really made a significant investment in putting the video right into the Link client. All right, so now, in the same conference, still, if you really don't like the way how we put the video, because you may not like it, right? Some people, I mean, we are all humans, we may decide that's not the way I like to see it. Let's move it away. So you can undock the video window, that gallery of people, and you can move it to the right or left if you want to, right? You can resize it, or even if you have like 2 screens, multiple monitors, you can take one monitor and leave the presentation or desktop sharing or whatever you are collaborating on that monitor and move your gallery to the other, enlarge it, and then you get a kind of like experience much better suited for this type of dual screen environment. Now, scheduled video conferences have a very special flavor, because for the ad hoc, when you are invited to the conference, you know, well, you actually, you know, at the moment you are being invited that you are in a conference, and but in a scheduled conference, when you enter the conference, you don't know yet what is the status of the conference, who is there, how many people, whatever. So at the moment when we enter the conference, we give the user who is entering the conference a kind of a preview of the conference. What do I mean by the preview? So the experience is very similar here, right? We have the views of the people who are active, and I'll explain what that active means in a moment. But then we also give the users that is entering the kind of a preview who else is in the conference. So we give an indication, a visual indication to that person that there are more people in the conference. Then one very important thing that I would like to highlight, we provide the user with a choice of entering the conference actively or just passively. By default, we enter the conference passively, meaning we are not sending audio, we are not sending video. That's what I meant by preview. We are just getting in the conference and our video is not being sent. So what the others will see, instead of my video image, will see my photographic representation. Very much like here, I don't see video feeds, I don't see live video, I see photographic representations. But if any of these people will start speaking up during the meeting, the video image of that person, let's say that lady, will be brought to that upper row of people, and that image will replace, that video feed actually will replace the video feed of last active person. So the last active person who spoke last in the past will be removed from that row, and that currently active person will replace it. And if you think about this, it kind of makes sense, because I don't really care about the people who are not active in a conference. If they are just listening, well, they are just passive. I don't really care. But if these people constantly talking in a conference, well, not constantly, but they talk and listen, they're active, then I'm really interested about what they are about to say. So I might want to look at them. So this is how we handle kind of like switching of the video in a multi-view gallery type of video experience. Now, I might also want to join the video, right? I might want to start expressing myself in the conference, not just by saying something. I have this option for previewing, and then if I decide to start sending my video, then my video will be one of the videos that's potentially is sent to the other people. And of course, if I start speaking up, if I unmute myself, my video will be seen by the others. Well, I will not see my own video, except for the small preview that keeps me assured that I'm still being seen. But other than that, of course, other people will see me if I speak up. Now, one more thing that I wanted to highlight here is that we are also providing the name of the person that is currently kind of active, because we sometimes don't know who is that lady, what's her name, right? So it's a good idea to have like indication. That indication can be turned on or off if you want to, depending on your needs. Then finally, you might find that here is the person that you are really interested in, not because she's a nice girl, but maybe she's your manager and you want to really know what's her view on what's being discussed. Even if she's silent, even if she doesn't speak anything, just listen, you want to see her. So what you can do is you can click on that little pin here, this little pin, like for pinning paper to the wall or something, and you can pin her. And if you pin her, she goes to some place in this gallery, and it stays there for you. So you always will see her, even if she doesn't speak, even if she's completely muted. That's quite important for some cases when you really want to know what other people think, even if they don't speak at all, right? So this is the video experience, and of course you can enlarge it with the collaboration. You can enlarge it with also a panorama video, which actually goes here at the bottom, right? All this magic is happening behind the scenes for you, thanks to the clever algorithms that we included in audio video MCU, link audio video MCU, or the link video bridge if you wish. And also, finally, if you want to, you can even further expand your experience from the video to include other modalities of collaboration like IM, right? You can IM while listening or viewing other people. And of course, you can also see the roster with the other participants. So this was more or less the user experience of the video. Switching views, using multiple views, ability to control When I'm being seen, whom I see, these are the most important features that we included. There's also one more important feature that's included in the Link 2013, and it's actually a very clever feature that I'm really proud of, that our developers put into the client, which is really a very clever way of building that the gallery that I've just shown you. So if you remember, in the gallery, we've seen square pictures, we've seen video in form of square pictures or tiles, right? Smart framing is something that actually produces the square from the normal video feed, because the normal video feed, as I told you, by definition is in a 16:9 aspect ratio. But then we have to kind of, you know, get this part of the video. But we have to be clever, because the person that is sitting in the front of the camera might move to the left or right. So we designed this algorithm that's called smart framing. And this is just a quick way of showing how it works for you. So basically, we have here a gentleman who is sitting in the front of the camera, and his camera is viewing him as well as part of the shelf here and part of the window here, right? Now, if that person joins the conference, this would be a normal viewing of the camera, right? If that person joins the conference, then the face detection algorithm detects where he's sitting right now and is choosing only that part of the video stream to be displayed, right? So he's sitting in the middle, see this frame here? So the frame is selected in the middle of the view of camera, of the viewing angle of the camera. Now, if that gentleman, unfortunately, this picture doesn't move, it was taken only one, but imagine that he's moved to this part of the room, right? So then the frame will also move, the face detection algorithm will detect that he's actually in that part of the viewing angle, and he'll keep showing me him, not the middle of the screen where he's not present anymore, right? Same if he would move to the left, right? Then the face detection algorithm would detect him again here. Again, please apologies, my apologies for this demonstration, which is not really well designed. He should be shown here on the picture, but you can see he's actually moved to that side of the screen here. This is something that would be shown in a conference. This is what people would see in a conference. That's a very clever of keeping the focus on a person during the video meeting. Because if I'm sitting in a video meeting for like 20 minutes, I might want to, from time to time, move a little bit, right? Even with my chair, just move, you know, a little bit during this long video call. And we are keeping the focus on the person still. Now, if there would be two people in the room at the same time, then the whole smart framing kind of is disabled. This face detection algorithm detects that there are two or more faces in the viewing angle of the camera right now, so we continue to send the image of the whole view of the camera. The whole view angle of the camera is being sent, and in conference you would see something like that as one of the tiles. Well, the tile would not be square then, would be like that, right? The frame would be like that, rectangle, and then you would see these two people in a viewing angle. Thanks to that technology, very clever technology inserted into the client, we keep the focus of the people that are attending conference on the other people. And that's what matters. Not showing the empty room, but showing the people who are attending the conference. Okay, so that was the user experience. And I thought it was quite important to kind of highlight these things, because in Link 2013, lots of things are being done for the video in the client. And you will see in a moment, because we are moving in a more technical design or design section, that a lot of this cleverness is backed up in a client as well from the, let's say, back side. Now, kind of looking into the past for a moment. So in 2010, Link 2010 version, we used a dedicated type of codec, video codec called RT Video, which was actually based on a VC1 standard or VC1 mechanism of encoding video. And that codec was used for both point-to-point and multipoint calls. If the multipoint calls were video calls were conducted, then the audio-video bridge was used. But this bridge wasn't very clever, let's be honest, in 2010. It was just switching video streams and actually switching just one video stream of the active participants. So people, all the people that were attending the conference, they could see only the single video stream. If more people had a better PCs or bigger screens or simply wanted to see better, if more people were enlarging their windows, the whole conference was switched to a larger resolution because the default resolution in Link 2010 was SIF. If more people, more actually than 60% of the people, switched their window to bigger, then the whole conference was upgraded to VGA resolution. That's how it worked in Link 2010. And that was pretty much it. We couldn't do high definition. We couldn't do any more clever stuff. And then something has happened. On the market, these wonderful devices appeared. Slates, tablets, smartphones, and people started asking, can you try to deliver video experience for us on these devices as well? People also started realizing that the SIF or even VGA type of experience is not necessarily something that's really great. They would like to see HD or even a full HD resolution because they simply had these big screens, high resolution laptops, and they wanted to see people in a full screen. So they started asking us, can you do something about it? And also, can you do something about showing us more than just one participant during the meeting? So we tried to work out that thing, and Link 2013, we had to include lots of innovations in video on the backside to deliver all these wonderful experiences that I talked in the beginning. And I'm going to walk through some of those things because it's very important to understand what's happening behind the screens if you want to design Link 2013 for the video properly. So there are a couple of them. There is an inclusion of new codec. It was already mentioned a couple of times during this conference. We include what's called H.264 scalable video coding codec. And we also include a special way of sending streams, video streams, called simulcast. And we allow AVMCU to send multiple video streams simultaneously to a single customer, for that single client, for that multiple video experience of multi-view gallery. And the smart framing, which I already discussed. So let me go slightly deeper into these technologies, because it's not they are curious or fantastic, it's just is they are important also to understand if you want to design. So the video codec, H.264, SVC, or scalable video codec, we are using what's called temporal scalability. Temporal scalability is basically in a single video stream, we kind of give the basic layer where we encode the video stream with a quite slow frame per second rate, 7.5 frame per second. Then we add additional layer of encoding of 15 frames per second. And then we add yet another one that allows to encode or decode video with 30 frames per second. You might think, why such a complexity? And the answer is very simple. Because not all of us, really, or actually not all devices that we are actually using, will be able to properly decode or encode video streams at 30 frames per second. Like these devices, like mobile phones, right, or smartphones, they don't necessarily have enough of CPU power, unless they are hardware accelerated, to process 30 frames per second and at slightly higher resolution than SIF or something like that. So that's why we needed to give the ability to have multiple frames per second. But then, why not build on one on top of the other, right? Why instead of building multiple different streams, these are just frames. So let's just try to make a video stream in a way so some devices could consume 30 frames per second, but some devices that cannot, they will just consume less. That makes quite a lot of sense. So that's why we worked on H.264 codec with this temporal scalability, hence the name scalable video codec. Now, we also support, for the sake of compatibility with the previous version of Link, we also support VC1 or RT video. We can encode or decode that. So basically, Link 2013 client can have a video call with Link 2010 client, but that will be used RT video codec. We also support, and this is kind of like looking into the future in a way, we also support what's called H.264 AVC or advanced video coding. Despite of name, the advanced video coding is actually kind of like previous generation of H.264, the kind of very static H.264 video stream, but it's very heavily used by vendors of traditional video conferencing system like Polycom, Sony, Cisco, Thunberg, whatever you comes to your mind. These vendors are most often using H.264 AVC codec. So we included that codec as well, or ability to encode and decode using H.264 AVC in a link client for the sake of future compatibility with these third-party vendors. And we'll discuss that later on in a couple of slides. Okay, so for the video quality, as I already said, we are capable of encoding or decoding of up to full high definition, 1080p, using H.264 SVC codec. And we can optimize using these frames per second thing, different streams to different participants. And the video bridge, the AVMCU, Link 2013 AVMCU, is capable of detecting which of the client can receive which type of the stream. Like this client is sitting on a low bandwidth link, so he can only accept 15 frames per second. Or maybe this client doesn't simply have enough of CPU power. It's running on a very slow PC, old generation PC. It doesn't have enough CPU power to get more than 15 frames per second. Then the AVMCU might decide that it's good to send just 15 frames per second from the same video stream. It's the same source video stream that provides video to both of these participants. And we also provide additional measures of providing the quality with the forward error correction, but this is something that was already there in Link 2010. Now, the other optimization in the video streams that we included in the Link 2013, it's called simulcast. Simulcast is kind of a combination of two words, simultaneous broadcasting, so simulcast. Simulcast is about the ability for the single link client to send multiple streams simultaneously. Why would a single link client need to send multiple streams? I already told you that it can just have one stream and then have it split into different frames per read. Yes, but there might be some other combinations. One of the combination might be that all of a sudden the video conference is joined by a big system, like a room system, or maybe simply a PC that has a capability to really encode and decode high definition resolution or full high definition resolution. In that sense, in that situation, it wouldn't make sense to change the resolution for these clients because, well, assumption is they are not capable of doing high definition video. So the simplest way of handling it is simply creating another stream, the stream with a high definition resolution, possibly 30 frames per second, and just sending it to that participant, right? Then another case might be when Link 2010 client joins the call. Then for this participant from Link 2010 client, the Link 2010 client can only accept RT video, so another RT video stream might be, another video stream might be sent from the single link client, this time encoded in RT video. And if you are getting scared that all of these things are going to eat up a lot of bandwidth, don't worry, come to my session in the evening and we'll try to explain it's not as scary as it sounds at the beginning. But the idea behind this is very simple. Instead of sending one stream, we are sending multiple, but we don't have to transcode or recode or change the resolution at the AVMCU. Changing resolution, changing encoding or decoding is a very heavy process. Very, very often, in order to do that for the video streams of these resolutions, you have to do it in hardware. We as Microsoft, we believe that the video streams are better processed in software, but then we cannot transcode them. So instead of transcoding, we are doing this simulcasting thing, right? And then we are making the video switching, not even bridging, video switching very effective. You can have a multiple video stream switch by a software-based video switch very effectively. It can process hundreds and hundreds of video streams that way. The effectiveness was behind the simulcast. Now, in order to properly process then the video streams, we also included in Link 2013 client the ability to reuse or make use of the hardware acceleration that different vendors provide in hardware. One of the vendors is Intel, which provides a very efficient hardware acceleration in their graphics card. The other vendors are coming as well. We also rely on DirectX video accelerator for decoding. So if we have these, you can even go on a simple dual core machine, dual core laptop or dual core desktop PC for a resolution of full high definition. And it's fully capable of process that provided that the hardware acceleration is there. If it's not there, then of course we'll get a slightly less resolution. And there is a document or technet that describes it in great detail. And I urge you to go there, because it's very clearly described what you can expect from what type PC in terms of resolutions provided by Link 2013 client. Okay, so what are the impacts on the design from the video perspective on the Link 2013 design? Well, actually, to be honest, Link 2013 design hasn't changed that much from the video perspective. We still have a clients that are capable of either talking one to each other, like this Link 15 client can talk video to let's say this one, the Link client on Windows 8 tablet, right, point to point, or we can have a multi-point conference handled by AV MCU with other types of clients like mobile clients or other PC-based clients, or even room systems, qualified room systems that will be able to register to Link and attend the conferences handled by Link AV MCU, audio-video MCU. Now, for these systems that are not directly compatible with Link, we have the interoperability mechanisms, and there are three of them. The most famous is depicted here. It's a third-party gateway, but that's not the only one. So actually, we can interoperate with the third-party systems in three ways. And I'll start from the bottom, because, again, it's the most common one, most well-known, is the gateway. The gateway is needed for video interoperability in Link 2013 for two reasons. Well, first reason is because of the... if we don't have the system that's directly registered to Link, then it's registered to some other system, Cisco Communication Manager, some other video system from Avaya, from Polycom, and we need to someone that is kind of like passing signaling between these two. Unfortunately, most often, just direct communication on SIP, based on SIP signaling between these two systems is not possible. There are very small differences in SIP signaling between vendors for the video, and unfortunately gateways are still necessary for kind of correcting signaling. The other reason for need for the gateway is because, and I come back to my previous slide for a moment, if these systems on the right side, the yellow systems, would need to join the conference on AVMCU on our Link video bridge, then joining the conference on AV-MCU requires certain additional information being sent in RTCP channel. RTCP channel is additional channel that's sent along the media stream with the video that allows to control that media stream of video. And this channel is typically not being created, it's not being sent from these systems. And also in this channel, we are sending additional information, or rather our Link video bridge is sending additional information on who is actually currently joining MCU, should what resolution should I get from the AVMCU? This kind of information is being sent not in SIP signaling channel, but on RTCP channel. This is very well described in our documentation. However, as of today, there are no vendors that implement this kind of additional mechanism that are required to, for joining or requesting video streams from our video bridges. So that's the video gateway is still in the picture, and that's the most common way of doing interoperability with these third-party video systems. The other two approaches is the ability to directly register video teleconference systems or video units directly into Link, and there are some vendors that produce such systems that are directly registered to the Link frontend. And yet the other one is the ability to use the third-party video bridge that could be used for the multi-party meetings, but then the third-party video MCU is not, of course, delivering the multi-view gallery experience. It will be delivering some kind of other experience for the video participants, including Link participants. And we have some vendors who provide this type of interoperability approaches. So from the design perspective, just to kind of summarize, for the native video, the design hasn't changed that much. We have the AVMCU, we have the clients. We have one little thing that changed, that the AVMCU, the audio video bridge of Link, is always now co-located with the frontend or located on a standard edition server, if you wish. It cannot be split because we found during our testing that actually there is no need from the effectiveness, from the scalability perspective. We can already combine that feature of the video bridging inside of the frontend, and you can spare one server for some other purposes. Now, you from the design perspective, you might want to think about putting front-end pools in different regions if for some reasons you want to group users with respect to how they use the video bridges, because the scalability of the video bridges is also limited by the one or wide area network bandwidth. And then you might want to think about regionalizing pools, like putting one pool in Moscow, putting the other pool in Novosibirsk, just for the sake of users from the more eastern part of Russia to have their video conferences handled in that part of the Link system. Again, lots of load is on the client, producing, encoding, decoding, switching video, requesting the switching of the video streams in terms of resolution. All the load is on the client, so you don't really have to think about that in terms of design, but you have to think about things like, all right, now since I have the high definition capabilities, I want to have high definition cameras as well. We want to have a good quality pictures in the video experience, hence we would probably want to have the something that's certified to work against Microsoft Link 2013. I would warn you about using the USB hubs and be very careful about using the video over wireless, at least for the beginning, because we see lots of wireless networks that are designed or were designed before actually people started using things like voice or video over wireless. So in these areas, when you are thinking about providing your user with capabilities of running the video over wireless, have some tests done upfront. Provide the user with the ability only after you are sure that your wireless network can carry the load of traffic that video can bring. And for the interoperability, of course, we provide the certified solutions. We will be providing certified solutions when they come to the market. So far, because Link 2013 has been only announced a couple of weeks ago, we don't yet have solutions certified with us, but we have some vendors that are actively working with us on providing video interop solutions certified to Link 2013. Excuse me. So switching gears a little bit now. Excuse me. We are going to talk now about collaboration features. Excuse me. That's what's happening if you drink the water too fast. So we are going to switch the gear a little bit now, and we will talk about the other part of the experience, which is always quite important, sometimes for some people even more important than video experience, which is a collaboration experience. So Link 2010, again, looking into the past a little bit, Link 2010 delivered lots of collaboration, lots of ways for collaboration, be it desktop sharing, be it PowerPoint sharing, be it whiteboarding, or just providing some documents or some other files that you could use during your meetings. These were all great features of Link 2010. And we are kind of continuing with them. Of course, with Link 2013, we haven't cut out anything. We are actually trying to optimize some of them or optimize some of their behavior from a perspective of how they are run in the background, let's put it that way. We are going to discuss three things only, because there are some other stuff, but three things I felt quite important to discuss here. So we'll start with the better layouts, and I will once again walk you at the very beginning through the very short user experience demo, if you wish, right, on the slides. So the first thing I would like to highlight is we kind of worked with the users, or slightly provide them with slightly more controllable environment for the collaboration experience. Slightly more controllable in terms of how users can better absorb and collaborate on the content that they are sharing that's being shared during the meeting. So you've seen that screenshot before already, but here is with a slightly different content and with a purpose. So when we talked to the users, we found that people collaborate on different type of content. Well, this is not a very, very strange thing to find out, but we kind of find out it only now that there is a different type of content. Typically, PowerPoint presentations or whatever other type of documents that don't require a very, very big focus, you can really kind of look at them from the distance and kind of like just listen to the people, and then users told us that it's very important for them to also see the reaction of the other people on that particular collaboration experience that's happening. So that's why for this type of collaboration we provide this type of view, where we have the video experience above, and I've already told you why the reasons are above, and we have a collaboration experience kind of below, because that's how the people kind of from the slightly distance absorb or participate in this type of meetings. However, there is a different type of content, which is usually in form of tables, like Microsoft Excel table or some Word document with the kind of tables that people collaborate a lot on, right? And for this type of content, when we really are focused on what's sitting in a single cell of the Excel or single row of the or single row of the table in the Microsoft Word or whatever single detail, then we really don't care that much about what people think, because we are discussing verbally and we are focusing on the content. So for this type of collaboration experience, we provide this view, which we call the active speaker overlay view, and this is where we remove the whole video experience and we just say keep the active speaker on the right, because we are more focused on what he's telling us to do or what we are discussing in that single cell, what should be placed there. And then finally, if you really, really, really want to focus on something that we work together on, we really don't care that much about we really don't care that much about the video experience. We really focus on the content. So that's the content only view. And of course, user has a full power of switching this on and off during the call. They are not preset. Each user can select its own view during the call, during the meeting. And they are not preset by the administrator, and we have full control as a user over them. I think it's great, because we are now giving users more flexibility to work and collaborate the way they want. Now, the other thing in terms of collaboration that we discovered was, well, guess what? People are making notes during meetings. Again, it wasn't very hard to discover, but we kind of finally discovered that people are making notes during meeting. And actually people, when they collaborate, they actually prepare for the meetings with notes. And actually, even if they finish the meeting, they still scribble some notes, they still put something after the meeting, and that's what the outcome of the meeting is, right? The kind of full notes of the whole meeting. So we felt that the collaboration experience that we were providing so far in OCS, in Link 2010, didn't fit very well in that model of reality where people are making notes before, during, and after the meeting. We felt that we had a good product for that. We have OneNote, right? OneNote is part of the office, is the product for making notes. But we didn't have a link between Microsoft Link and Microsoft OneNote. So someone finally came to the kind of conclusion that it's a good idea to have that link. And we made that link, and we made it quite a clever way. Once again, I would like to emphasize that we are linking OneNote with Link, not just for the meeting, but for the whole process of the meeting, because it's a process before, during, and after. So before the meeting, we are actually scheduling the meeting, and we should also, if you want to leverage this nice functionality, we want to also prepare something what's called shared OneNote. So basically, we want to have a shared OneNote notebook, probably placed on a Microsoft SharePoint, or you could put it on a SkyDrive and share it with the people. Now, then during the meeting, you are actively collaborating. You can actively collaborate on that notes, on these shared notes. And after the meeting, if you still need to place something into the meeting, you can do that. And Microsoft Link will also place into the meeting notes your history of your collaboration, the documents, the information that you shared during the meeting in the form of PowerPoint or whiteboards. All that will become the big kind of script of the whole meeting. So it's easier to understand that if I show you a couple of screenshots. So let me walk through the experience. So again, before the meeting, if we start the idea about having a meeting, we invite people and we make it a Link meeting. And then we can add a OneNote to that meeting. And if that's a shared OneNote, the important thing is, even before the meeting, the participants will be able to view and collaborate on these notes. So some people, even before the actual Link meeting starts, they will be able to put some documents, some questions, maybe some remarks, or some topics that they would like to discuss into that meeting notes. It's like throwing things at the table, you know, when you are entering the room, just before you actually started the meeting. That's what this is all about. Then, when you are actually one more thing I would like to note is actually you can either work on the shared notes, and shared notes is where everybody will that is invited to the meeting, provided that the proper permissions are assigned, will be able to collaborate on that meeting notes, or you want to have still your own private notes, but still benefit from some things that Link will provide you, and just in a moment I'll show you what are these things, during making your own private notes. So what exactly Link will give you when you actually start the meeting? So when you start the meeting, and if you go into the meeting as an organizer, or actually any other person, for that sake, but typically it's organizer that starts sharing the notes, when you start sharing the notes during the meeting, your OneNote will be brought to your screen along with the Link client. And then, first thing that I would like to notice, and again, it might be very hard for these of you who are sitting in the back to see that, but here in the OneNote, the Link automatically fills certain things in the Link in the OneNote. The first thing that it fills automatically for you is information of the meeting. What is the subject of the meeting? What was the meeting ID? Who organized that? When it was held? Kind of like logistics information, but not for the purpose of attending the meeting, but later on, for the purpose of if the people come back to these notes, they will know when that meeting, Link meeting, has happened. The second thing that is being filled in automatically for you is the list of participants. So Link will automatically get list of participants and will place that into OneNote. And also, I'm sorry about the resolution of the screen, it's really almost impossible to see it, but here's a little check mark indicating that this person is actually attending the meeting, right? And actually here it says joined by the Link. So you will have after the meeting, you will have information who actually joined the meeting, not just who was invited. You will see who actually worked in that meeting with you. Then, the third thing, during the meeting, you might want to share different things. You might want to share PowerPoint, you might want to share some Word files, you might do some whiteboarding things, and all these things are automatically copied to your OneNote. Kind of like, if you start sharing the PowerPoint, of course it's shared, but then it's also copied here. The file is copied there. And if you finish the meeting, that gives you a nice summary of the whole meeting. You can still edit it, you can still kind of add some things, and then later on, you can simply send it, or just leave it on shared site or SharePoint or SkyDrive, and have it there for the other people that might be coming to these notes to see what was discussed, what was the outcome. I think it's a great addition to the whole meeting, because now people are really keen to go with meetings and have these things done in a more organized way. And with that, I would like to finish, because my time is almost over, and I'd like still to give you some chance for the questions. So if that's okay with you, I'll just switch to my last Microsoft logo slide, right? And that, yeah. If I can only switch there. And that gives us, actually, I have some more slides for you in the back for your own reading later on. And we still have some time for questions if you have any. There is a question in the back, I believe. Oh, there's one in the front, yes.
Hello, I'm from Siemens Enterprise Communications. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask one question. I see a huge issue with ergonomics of the video conferencing. Maybe I'm not right and it's resizing somehow, but I can see the thin line of video frames and a lot of free space top and the bottom. Is mm-hmm. it solved somehow or?
Yeah, so yeah, it's not a question, it's a remark rather, right? That the ergonomics of the video conference mm-hmm. experience, multi-view gallery experience, is kind of not very ergonomic, because there is like a gallery of people, lots of empty space up there and lots of empty space down there. Yeah. So we found out at the very beginning when we were designing that approach, that people, when they look at the monitor, right, they primarily focus their eyesight like this, right? At the very middle, right? So I agree with you partially. It may be kind of like, I don't like this type of experience. We found that people prefer to look straight than look kind of right or left or down on the screen. Mm-hmm. But it's an individual experience, and if you don't like that one, you can always kind of squeeze the window and move it right or left. That's my answer for you.
Yeah, I got you, but the question is, if we are speaking about the enterprise-grade video conferencing solution, not the part of collaboration system, I think the user should have the full screen of the frames, something like this, not the thin line.
Yeah, so the comment was, again, if we are talking about the video only experience that the user mm-hmm. should have the ability to have a full frames. The interesting thing that we found that 75% of the conferences are actually about the collaboration. Mm-hmm. So we tried to optimize our experience of video towards more collaboration. 75% of the conferences in our initial deployments of Link 2013 have video together with some desktop some sharing of applications, whatever. So that's why we went that way. And okay. trust me, our initial experience when we initially delivered it in a very, very first beta version was slightly different. The way that we are showing it now was based on that user feedback.
Okay, one more question. Mm-hmm. According to the collaboration itself, is it possible during the collaboration session to edit the documents? I mean, one or other or some different participant add some notes, not on OneNote application, but on document itself. for example, new entries, remove some.
Yeah. So the way to do it. So the question basically was if it's possible to edit documents during the collaboration session.
Yeah.
So the way to do it, there are two ways to do it, to be honest, right? But the typical ways to do it is by sharing the documents, someone.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of sharing the application, and someone is just working on it, passing the ability to edit the document, you know, to other people, right? Or the other way to do it is to put the document on shared site, like a SharePoint site, and have the access that site done by other people, and just do the collaboration that way and share the view, because all the people can collaborate via the SharePoint site that way on the document then.
Oh, so Link have the possibility to give the rights to edit the document. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah. There was one more question in the back.
It's okay. If I'm correct, multiple video streams coming from clients, it means increased bandwidth. Yes, am I right? And what are the average bandwidths for different resolutions of
video?
I kind
of expected that question. So the quick answer is yet. Honestly, and I don't want to leave you with that answer, you are probably misled by thinking that if we have like five video streams, that means five high definition streams. That's not the true. If we are doing the multi-view gallery experience, we have multiple streams of much lower resolution because we have smaller tiles. And especially if you have a collaboration, PowerPoint, desktop sharing, whatever, you need even less. Hence, and if you come to my session at 4 p.m. or at 6 p.m., right, I'll try to explain the mechanism behind. And funny enough, we found in our testing, initial testing, that's strange, but that's what's happening, that the multi-view gallery conference actually can occupy even less bandwidth on average than point-to-point session. Because in point-to-point sessions, people usually quickly enlarge the window to the full high definition, right, or high definition, and that's a big video stream. While in multi-view gallery conference, people are staying with the default view, and the default, by average, yields less bandwidth or requires less bandwidth than a single point-to-point full high-definition stream. That's the answer. But details will be provided by me at session at 6. There's two more questions here. I think we are over time, so I'll just handle one question, and if you can just come to me later on, because we want to let the other people
Hello.
Go.
Yes. I wanted to ask, am I correct? When we make some private notes, we use our local OneNote application.
That is correct.
And is there any functionality which Link integrates with our local OneNote, like with shared notes?
So the functionalities, so the question was basically, if we are using private OneNote, not shared OneNote, will we have some Link functionalities provided by Link to the notes? So these things, like I've shown, the list of participants, content of shared during the meeting, they will go to the private notes as well.
And for private notes too?
Yes. So exactly the same things, except this will be just your own notes. They will be shared during the meeting. With that, I think we'll close. Thank you very much. Большое спасибо.
Very much. We'll meet you. We'll see you again at 6 p.m.
As cool as a tree, as scary as the sea, as warm as the sun, as silly as fun, as hot as fire, cold as ice, sweet as sugar and everything nice. Say,
Oh, лаборатории Касперского – динамично развивающаяся компания, чья основная деятельность охватывает сферу информационной безопасности. Она входит в четверку ведущих мировых производителей антивирусных программных решений, которые пользуются популярностью в сотни стран.
За последние несколько лет количество разработчиков, тестировщиков, других специалистов подразделения R&D, Research & Development, нашей компании выросло почти до 900 человек. У нас большое количество распределенных команд разработки, которые находятся по всему миру. Естественно, что исторически закладывалось, что у каждой из них были свои наработки по методологиям, по технологиям производства. У нас было большое количество инструментов поддержки производства программного обеспечения. Поэтому простейшая операция по передаче требования, например, из одного проекта в другой, а у нас очень много проектов, которые между собой связаны, занимала очень много времени и отнимала большое количество сил. Поэтому мы искали инструмент, который позволит нам сократить эти издержки. В итоге мы выбрали Team Foundation Server. Это чуть ли не единственная унифицированная платформа поддержки командной разработки программного обеспечения, которая поддерживает все современные методологии.
Первоначально планировалось внедрить Team Foundation Server только для разработчиков, а тестировщиков оставить текущую систему. Однако прикидки показали, что внедрение для обеих категорий пользователей будет практичнее и дешевле. В текущей версии Team Foundation Server заметно улучшилось тестирование и обеспечение качества программных продуктов, что, собственно, и послужило одним из главных критериев при выборе этого инструмента. Платформа содержит полный набор инструментов для всех ролей команды разработки. Она основана на Visual Studio, и мы не видим препятствий для разработчиков, использующих другие операционные системы, работать с TFS.
Пилотный проект по внедрению Team Foundation Server был начат в 2011 году. И в том же 2011 году мы его успешно завершили. После успешного завершения пилотной эксплуатации Team Foundation Server в инфраструктурном направлении было принято решение о внедрении Team Foundation Server в R&D в целом. Было закуплено дополнительное оборудование, создана распределенная система на базе трех дата-центров, и сейчас различные команды уже начали миграцию на TFS. Сначала, естественно, мигрируют те команды, которым это делать проще, у которых инструменты которых позволяют нативную миграцию в TFS, а те же команды, инструменты которых не представляют такой легкой возможности перейти, будут переходить чуть позже в этом году. Для них мы разрабатываем соответствующие инструменты миграции. Сейчас в Team Foundation Server ведется более 100 проектов и насчитывается около 500 пользователей, что является более чем половиной от R&D, то есть очень development в лаборатории Касперского.
Лаборатория Касперского выбрала Team Foundation Server для организации процесса разработки, потому что TFS предоставляет все необходимые инструменты для этого, включая контроль версий, тестирование, билд-процесс и так далее. Особое значение имеет система построения отчетности, потому что все артефакты трассируются. Это имеет большое значение для организации бизнес-процесса в лаборатории Касперского.
В результате внедрения нового решения лаборатория Касперского получила интегрированную и унифицированную среду разработки. Взаимосвязи между проектами стали более очевидными и прозрачными. Кроме того, решение от Microsoft позволило преодолеть проблему трассировки требований. Внедрение решения Team Foundation Server позволило реализовать трассировку как внутри проектов, так и между ними. Без TFS выполнение многих рутинных операций требовало слишком много времени. Так, например, поиск выполненных требований занимал несколько часов и требовал иногда усилия почти всей команды. Сейчас эту работу выполняет один человек всего за 3-4 клика. Решение Team Foundation Server оправдывает наши ожидания. Оно позволяет организовать работу команды и работать достаточно стабильно и эффективно. Опираясь на наш опыт, мы можем рекомендовать продукт другим компаниям.
Лаборатория Касперского – известный производитель антивирусного программного обеспечения. Все мы знаем, насколько важно защитить компьютеры от вредоносного ПО. Поэтому мы очень рады, что лаборатория Касперского выбрала Microsoft Visual Studio и Team Foundation Server для организации эффективного процесса создания программного обеспечения, стоящего на страже миллионов компьютеров по всему миру.
База команды «Формула-1 Lotus» находится в Оксфордшире, Англия. Нас около 540 человек, и мы участвуем в чемпионате мира FIA «Формула-1». Каждый год мы проезжаем 20 трасс, и за каждым соревнованием наблюдает около 800 миллионов зрителей. Сейчас в команде проводится программа преобразования бизнеса. Мы хотим победить в чемпионате 2014 года, и задача программы – полностью к этому подготовиться. Мы активно инвестируем в своих работников, в технологии, и нам абсолютно необходимо совершенствовать свои процессы. И поэтому мы сначала оценили 13 ERP-систем и лишь потом приняли решение. Мы связались с подрядчиками, связались с аналитиками, которые изучали доступные решения и знали, какое из них лучше подойдет для нашего бизнеса. Мы составили список и оценили каждое из них. Никаких сомнений. Первое место заняло решение Microsoft Dynamics. У нас работают превосходные мастера, но им часто приходится руководствоваться своей интуицией и опытом, а не той информацией, которая у нас уже есть. Это та управленческая информация, которая необходима, чтобы принять решение о том, какую деталь проработать, какой материал использовать, как это скажется на бюджете, каким последствиям приведет позже, когда начнется сезон. И Microsoft Dynamics AX помогает нам находить именно те данные, которые помогут разработать более скоростной болид. Мы работаем в рамках соглашения об ограничении использования ресурсов. Глобальная экономика переживает сейчас не лучшие времена, однако мы должны делать все возможное, чтобы опередить другие команды Формулы-1. И та команда, которая продуманно потратит свои средства, никогда не придет последней. Именно эту задачу и помогает нам выполнить Microsoft Dynamics. Обычно, когда отдел эргономики заканчивает работу, они передают ее в конструкторский отдел, а оттуда она переходит в производство. Иногда случается так, что на заводе изготавливают детали, которые уже были усовершенствованы конструкторами и эргономистами. На это уходит масса ресурсов, но панели инструментов, которые входят в состав Microsoft Dynamics AX, помогают нам избежать такого снижения производительности. Сорок процентов наших сотрудников регулярно работают, находясь за пределами завода. И для того, чтобы они могли подключаться к сети, мы вынуждены поддерживать VPN. На мой взгляд, это безумие. Чем больше информации я размещу в безопасной облачной системе, тем быстрее они получат нужные им данные, и тем быстрее будет принято нужное решение. В данный момент управление кадрами не связано с ERP-системой. Это очень неудобно, потому что в ней записаны все навыки каждого сотрудника. Но когда к нам поступает новое оборудование, очень сложно определить, где найти самого опытного оператора. Мы хотим собрать всю информацию о работниках в ERP-системе. И именно эту возможность дает нам Microsoft Dynamics AX. По сути, в болиде Формулы-1 все зависит от отдела разработок. Для создания машины приходится подготавливать по 20-25 тысяч чертежей. Но инвестиции в решение Microsoft помогут отделам разработок и производства работать более эффективно. Мы должны постоянно внедрять инновации, непрерывно вносить изменения. И именно в этом и заключается основное преимущество решения Microsoft. Все команды Формулы-1, по сути, борются за одних и тех же партнеров, спонсоров и технических специалистов. Модуль CRM — это единая система, куда можно ввести всю информацию, которая поможет нам сохранить своих спонсоров. Ведь контракты рано или поздно заканчиваются. И если другие команды справятся со своей работой лучше, мы рискуем потерять своих партнеров. Microsoft Dynamics AX — это решение номер один, безо всяких сомнений. И это подтверждают оценки, которые мы провели. Мы приступаем к его внедрению. Я доволен этим решением. Уверен, что мы поможем своей команде победить в чемпионате 2014 года.
Лидер среди российских розничных сетей по продаже электроники и бытовой техники и одна из крупнейших европейских компаний, работающих в этом сегменте. По итогам 2011 года оборот компании M-Video превысил 130 миллиардов рублей. В компании работают более 17 тысяч сотрудников в более 280 гипермаркетах в 120 городах России. Многие годы информационно-управляющие системы и сети магазинов M-Video строились на платформе Microsoft Visual Basic. Эти системы используются для управления нашими филиалами и являются важнейшим элементом IT-среды как в торговых залах, так и во вспомогательных подразделениях. Магазинов. За годы работы мы постоянно наращивали функциональные возможности, повышающие ценность этой платформы для бизнеса.
Однако при этом разрастался штат IT-специалистов, бизнес-аналитиков и разработчиков. Несколько лет назад, в 2010 году, мы решили внедрить службу Microsoft Team Foundation Server. Зачем? Мы знали, что эти службы беспрепятственно интегрируются с новыми и прежними версиями Visual Studio, упрощают управление новыми разработками и дают возможность безопасно администрировать существующий код.
Опыт использования Team Foundation Server в компании NVIDIA подтверждает, что система легко воспринимается разработчиками ПО, аналитиками, тестировщиками. Руководству она позволяет сконцентрироваться на управлении общим ходом проекта, контролируя отдельные задачи. Приобретение Team Foundation Server позволило нам получить техническую поддержку компании Microsoft по развитию системы по настройкам. Архитектурное решение строилось точно в соответствии с рекомендацией компании Microsoft. Мы установили две виртуальные машины, на одной из них Team Foundation Server, на второй машине необходимую для его работы реализационную базу данных Microsoft SQL Server. Рабочие процессы мы стали автоматизировать на основе методологии CMMI, прилагающейся к Team Foundation Server по умолчанию. После успешного внедрения Team Foundation Server в подразделение разработки в течение года мы автоматизировали бизнес-процессы смежных подразделений – логистического, торгового, интернет-магазина, веб-портала. Мы наладили учет исходных кодов программ на платформе SharePoint и Java.
Кроме того, мы отметили рост качества и скорости разработки программных продуктов, а именно этого от меня, как от IT-директора, требует руководство сети магазинов. Team Foundation Server – это отличный продукт, благодаря которому работа IT-подразделения приносит бизнесу еще больше выгод.
В настоящий момент в компании NVIDIA подразделение по контролю качества эксплуатации программных комплексов регистрирует все изменения в программных продуктах в системе Assist. Чтобы избежать дублирования функционала и дать возможность работникам взаимодействовать с единой системой, следующим шагом по внедрению системы TFS будет объединение систем Assist и TFS, чтобы они работали как единое целое. Также скоро мы планируем внедрять новый функционал, который входит в версию TFS 2012. Внедрение новых средств разработки Visual Studio позволит полностью автоматизировать процесс тестирования программных продуктов, а также обеспечить автоматический сбор и отслеживание требований к новым разрабатываемым программным комплексам. Для такой большой компании, как NVIDIA, является критически важным обеспечивать автоматизированное отслеживание требований и вообще полностью контролировать весь цикл разработки программных продуктов. Именно эту задачу мы и помогаем решить компании NVIDIA посредством наших новых продуктов Visual Studio и сервер TFS.
tree, as scary as the sea, as warm as the sun, as silly as fun, as hot as fire, cold as ice, sweet as sugar and everything nice. Say,
лаборатория Касперского – динамично развивающаяся компания, чья основная деятельность охватывает сферу информационной безопасности. Она входит в четверку ведущих мировых производителей антивирусных программных решений, которые пользуются популярностью в сотни стран.
За последние несколько лет количество разработчиков, тестировщиков, других специалистов подразделения R&D, Research and Development, нашей компании выросло почти до 900 человек. У нас большое количество распределенных команд разработки, которые находятся по всему миру. Естественно, что исторически закладывалось, что у каждой из них были свои наработки по методологиям, по технологиям производства. У нас было большое количество инструментов поддержки производства программного обеспечения. Поэтому простейшая операция по передаче требования, например, из одного проекта в другой, а у нас очень много проектов, которые между собой связаны, занимало очень много времени и отнимало большое количество сил. Поэтому мы искали инструмент, который позволит нам сократить эти издержки. В итоге мы выбрали Team Foundation Server. Это чуть ли не единственная унифицированная платформа поддержки командной разработки программного обеспечения, которая поддерживает все современные методологии.
Первоначально планировалось внедрить Team Foundation Server только для разработчиков, а тестировщиков оставить текущую систему. Однако прикидки показали, что внедрение для обеих категорий пользователей будет практичнее и дешевле. Текущая версия Team Foundation Server заметно улучшилась тестирование и обеспечение качества программных продуктов, что, собственно, и послужило одним из главных критериев при выборе этого инструмента. Платформа содержит полный набор инструментов для всех ролей команды разработки. Она основана на Visual Studio, и мы не видим препятствий для разработчиков, использующих другие операционные системы, работать с TFS.
Пилотный проект по внедрению Team Foundation Server был начат в 2011 году. И в том же 2011 году мы его успешно завершили. После успешного завершения пилотной эксплуатации Team Foundation Server в инфраструктурном направлении было принято решение о внедрении Team Foundation Server в R&D в целом. Было закуплено дополнительное оборудование, создана распределенная система на базе трех дата-центров, и сейчас различные команды уже начали миграцию на TFS. Сначала, естественно, мигрируют те команды, которым это делать проще, у которых инструменты которых позволяют нативную миграцию в TFS. А те же команды, инструменты которых не предоставляют такой легкой возможности перейти, будут переходить чуть позже в этом году. Для них мы разрабатываем соответствующие инструменты миграции. Сейчас в Team Foundation Server ведется более 100 проектов и насчитывается около 500 пользователей, что является более чем половиной от R&D, Research and Development, лаборатории Касперского.
Лаборатория Касперского выбрала Team Foundation Server для организации процесса разработки, потому что TFS предоставляет все необходимые инструменты для этого, включая контроль версий, тестирование, билд-процесс и так далее. Особое значение имеет система построения отчетности, потому что все артефакты трассируются. Это имеет большое значение для организации бизнес-процесса в лаборатории Касперского.
В результате внедрения нового решения лаборатория Касперского получила интегрированную и унифицированную среду разработки. Взаимосвязи между проектами стали более очевидными и прозрачными. Кроме того, решение от Microsoft позволило преодолеть проблему трассировки требований. Внедрение решения Team Foundation Server позволило реализовать трассировку как внутри проектов, так и между ними. Без TFS выполнение многих рутинных операций требовало слишком много времени. Так, например, поиск выполненных требований занимал несколько часов и требовал иногда усилия почти всей команды. Сейчас эту работу выполняет один человек всего за 3-4 клика. Решение Team Foundation Server оправдывает наши ожидания. Оно позволяет организовать работу команды и работать достаточно стабильно и эффективно. Опираясь на наш опыт, мы можем рекомендовать продукт другим компаниям.
Лаборатория Касперского – известный производитель антивирусного программного обеспечения. Все мы знаем, насколько важно защитить компьютеры от вредоносного ПО. Поэтому мы очень рады, что лаборатория Касперского выбрала Microsoft Visual Studio и Team Foundation Server для организации эффективного процесса создания программного обеспечения, стоящего на страже миллионов компьютеров по всему миру.
База команды Формулы-1 Lotus находится в Оксфордшире, Англия. Нас около 540 человек, и мы участвуем в чемпионате мира FIA Формула-1. Каждый год мы проезжаем 20 трасс, и за каждым соревнованием наблюдает около 800 миллионов зрителей. Сейчас в команде проводится программа преобразования бизнеса. Мы хотим победить в чемпионате 2014 года, и задача программы – полностью к этому подготовиться. Мы активно инвестируем в своих работников, в технологии, и нам абсолютно необходимо совершенствовать свои процессы. И поэтому мы сначала оценили 13 ERP-систем и лишь потом приняли решение. Мы связались с подрядчиками, связались с аналитиками, которые изучали доступные решения и знали, какое из них лучше подойдет для нашего бизнеса. Мы составили список и оценили каждое из них. Никаких сомнений. Первое место заняло решение Microsoft Dynamics. У нас работают превосходные мастера, но им часто приходится руководствоваться своей интуицией и опытом, а не той информацией, которая у нас уже есть. Это та управленческая информация, которая необходима, чтобы принять решение о том, какую деталь проработать, какой материал использовать, как это скажется на бюджете, каким последствиям приведет позже, когда начнется сезон. И Microsoft Dynamics AX помогает нам находить именно те данные, которые помогут разработать более скоростной болид. Мы работаем в рамках соглашения об ограничении использования ресурсов. Глобальная экономика переживает сейчас не лучшие времена, однако мы должны делать все возможное, чтобы опередить другие команды Формулы-1. И та команда, которая продуманно потратит свои средства, никогда не придет последней. Именно эту задачу и помогает нам выполнить Microsoft Dynamics. Обычно, когда отдел эргономики заканчивает работу, они передают ее в конструкторский отдел, а оттуда она переходит в производство. Иногда случается так, что на заводе изготавливают детали, которые уже были усовершенствованы конструкторами и эргономистами. На это уходит масса ресурсов, но панели инструментов, которые входят в состав Microsoft Dynamics AX, помогают нам избежать такого снижения производительности. Сорок процентов наших сотрудников регулярно работают, находясь за пределами завода. И для того, чтобы они могли подключаться к сети, мы вынуждены поддерживать VPN. На мой взгляд, это безумие. Чем больше информации я размещу в безопасной облачной системе, тем быстрее они получат нужные им данные, и тем быстрее будет принято нужное решение. В данный момент управление кадрами не связано с ERP-системой. Это очень неудобно, потому что в ней записаны все навыки каждого сотрудника. Но когда к нам поступает новое оборудование, очень сложно определить, где найти самого опытного оператора. Мы хотим собрать всю информацию о работниках в ERP-системе. И именно эту возможность дает нам Microsoft Dynamics AX.
Good afternoon. I'm Larry Lieberman. I'm a product manager at Microsoft. In Redmond and the Windows Phone team. Today we're going to talk to you about notifications and tiles in Windows Phone 8. If you have seen Windows Phone at all, I'm sure you're aware that tiles are perhaps one of the most distinctive, compelling aspects of Windows Phone. And tiles really are not that interesting or useful unless you have applications that use the tiles. So it's very important, and it's exciting for us to share with you ways that you can leverage tiles to really bring a lot of character and distinctiveness to your applications. Windows Phone 8 is really a huge release for us, and tiles and notifications are one of the big ways in which we've enhanced Windows Phone. We've given you more ways to integrate with the operating system. We've given you more of the capabilities that we had not previously exposed to developers. So there's a lot of really interesting material here. I'm excited to show it to you today. Before we get started, though, how many of you have seen Windows Phone 8? You've seen the new tile sizes? Yeah, so we'll talk a little bit about that, but there's also new tile templates. There's new notification types. It's one of the most important characteristics of the phone itself. I mean, we talk about the phone being a personal phone that you make your own, and having those tiles there on the home screen that light up, that show people the information they care about, is the main way that that takes place. So think about that as we go through some of these things. Before we go into what's new, I'll just spend a few minutes talking about where we are right now in terms of what tiles are. Because obviously we've had the product for a while. We've had Windows Phone. And in 7.5, we enhanced and extended what you could do with tiles. Now in 8, we're doing even more. So that's sort of what the agenda is today. A lot of this talk is going to be focused on the actual code that you write to leverage a lot of these features. So we'll go through a pretty good sample application that demonstrates how to use these features. So what do we have so far in Windows Phone? Before we go into the coding, it's important to get a clear picture of the user experience pieces. On the left-hand side there, you'll see what a tile looks like. And obviously, it's got a graphical characteristic to it. There's a background image. There's a count. There's a tile, a title. And that's on the front of the tile. We also have back of tile now as of Windows Phone 7.5 that developers can leverage. You can show the back content. You can also have an image there. And you can also update the back title as well. Now, on the right-hand side, you see toast notifications. This is one of the ways that you can actually communicate with the user in a more immediate manner, either locally with application processes running in the background or through push notification. The push notification service is one way that you can communicate with the end user more directly, too. Of course, push notifications require that you have a server application that drives that experience. And we know that that's a lot of additional work for many people. But we're also driving really hard to create solutions like Windows Azure Mobile Services. I don't know if you guys have seen any of the information about that. But with Azure Mobile Services, it's easier than ever for you to create an application that lives in the cloud that could drive notification experiences. So one of the biggest hurdles for developers has always been the hosting and staging of a server application. So we think Azure Mobile Services is going to really make that a much easier thing to do. But this is what we had as of Windows Phone 7.5. What does our push notification structure look like? Because I think it's important just to touch on this really quickly in case you're not familiar with how this works today. You can add push notification to your application. What this enables you to do is send updates to that app in a dynamic manner, even when the app's not running. So if you want to update weather, if you want to update stocks, if you want to send down new news stories, that's the sort of thing that you would do with push notification. And the way that this works is you basically use our service called MPNS, the Microsoft Push Notification Service, to do this, to accomplish this. The application itself works through a push client service on the phone to get a unique identifier that then gets sent to your cloud application. Your cloud application then uses that unique identifier to communicate with all of the apps that are running all the phones that are running your app. So basically, MPNS is a server service that enables you to address everybody running your app. And that's how it works today. Now, after 7.5, we did hear a few things back. We had a limit of 30 applications using push notifications on one phone at a time. And people didn't like that fact. They always were afraid that they were going to be the 31st app. We heard that people wanted to have more of the functionality of the tiles. They saw that we were doing things in our apps that they couldn't do in their apps. And so that was another piece of feedback we heard a lot about. We knew that the tile API was pretty easy to use, but there was inconsistencies because we had shell tile, and then we also had shell tile schedule. These two, and the two APIs were not necessarily that consistent with each other. And, overall, we knew that the developers wanted to do more of those built-in things that we did. So we'll go through some of what we've done to try to address those. In push, we've taken away the 30 endpoint limit. So now there's no longer any limitation on the number of applications running on any one phone that can leverage push notification. We also have this new feature called DataSense. And in Windows Phone, one of the biggest principles is that the end user has control over the phone. DataSense is a new feature in Windows Phone 8 that enables end user to specify that when they start to hit a data limit on a mobile operator plan, that it can shut down network activity automatically in an automatic manner. So Push obviously respects that, and it plays a role in understanding how Push works. We also now have the ability to launch VoIP applications with push notifications. This is how the VoIP background service now works in Windows Phone. But the really, really compelling new things going on here are with regard to live tiles. And we've updated the API with a real eye towards consistency. So today there are three different APIs here that we're really talking about. Push, shell tile, and shell tile schedule. These are the ways that you control push notification, or the actual alerts that show up in your tiles and your notifications. But in 7.5, in shell tile, for example, front image and back image, you could control those, but you could not initialize them with remote images. You could only initialize them with local images. And shell tile schedule was not consistent at all. You could actually use those for remote images for the front image, but it didn't do anything else at all. And now we fixed that. So we've got shell tile schedule being able to leverage all the aspects of a tile. And we've actually fixed shell tile so it now actually can use remote images for both front and back of the tile at the start. We've also added the ability to leverage XML payloads. And if you do any push notification work, this is important because that's how you actually control tiles. That's this type of message payload that you send down from your server application. And if you're familiar with using XML that way, it could be quite, it'd make a lot of sense for you to also leverage XML in building your local tile, and as opposed to using the strongly typed parameters. The big deal, though, is these new templates that we're addressing, because we've got three new templates. The flip template is essentially the update to the existing standard tile. And you'll notice here the three sizes as well. That's the other thing that's really important. We now support wide tile, medium, and we always had the medium tile, obviously. But now we also support this wide tile of 691 by 336. The medium tile has changed to 336 by 336 it was about half that resolution before. We've also gotten rid of the gutter in Windows Phone 8, so we no longer have this gutter, so that's given us more room for tile size. And then we have the small tile. Now, if you haven't done, your existing applications will run and they'll automatically get a small tile. You don't automatically get the large tile. The large tile is one that we didn't believe we could actually approximate programmatically. So there's more issues there with regard to existing applications. I'll talk about that a little bit later on. But the thing to note here is that a couple other things. The count information is the same on all these tiles, but you can use a different image on wide versus medium. And you can also use different content on the back, wide versus medium. On the wide tile, each line is a different field parameter that you can actually put your own information that you want on it. So the next tile template that I want to talk about is the cycle tile template. A lot of people told us that they loved our Photo Hub template, and they wanted to be able to automatically generate a tile that looked and worked just like the tile for Photo Hub. So now you have this. So this lets you take 9 local images and cycle them, and it automatically composes the tile and performs the animations. The wide tile size will center crop to medium. It uses the same 9 images for both wide and medium. And it also, so the way that this works is it uses local images, because 9 is a lot, and we didn't think that it made sense to have all 9 brought down at one time. So the way that we think people are going to use this is to use a background agent to get the images on a periodic basis to update the images. The last and perhaps most interesting new template is the iconic template. This is the one that we got an enormous amount of requests for. A lot of people ended up trying to approximate what this looks like by composing an image on the server and pushing that image down. And that's a lot of work. So now we do it for you automatically with this template. It has a count value. The count value is this beautiful icon. It uses a number of different images for the small icon image and the medium-sized icon image. The content on the wide tile is, again, this is more textual-based. So you've got three lines of text that you can control as well in the icon template. And it has a lot of beautiful animations built in. So when you first go to your start screen, the numbers count up. So in a kind of interesting way. We'll look at that in a minute. So I want to take a look now at some of the tile features, and we'll look at what these look like in code and how they work. And what I've got here is this application. It's a sample application called, So this is an emulator here. I've got all the tiles removed because we're going to do a lot of tile work. So I thought it makes sense to, except for photos, the Photos Hub. If I come down here, this application is called the Final Countdown. And what it does is it cycles through images and quotes about the Apollo 8 mission, which was a mission to the moon back in the 70s, or the 60s actually. It was the first one that actually where they went around the moon. So it's just an example app. It's pretty trivial. But what it does is it actually does go through and leverages all of the tile functionality. So it's got two pivots here, tiles and lock. And we'll talk about lock in a minute. But tiles here, you'll see primary tile, iconic tile, flip tile, and cycle tile. And the ability to create the tile, to update or remove. And then for primary, we can update or reset because we don't allow you to programmatically control the primary tile. Primary tile is the user's choice. The user has to put it on there themselves. If you have an interesting primary tile, you can, of course, alert the user to this fact. So one pattern we recommend is, you may want to, on the first launch, say, hey, by the way, I have a really interesting, compelling live tile. And you can pin that to your start screen if you want to see a lot of interesting things. So let's go through this here and look at what it looks like. You know, I just pinned my tile here like this, but if I go in, and we'll actually run this in the debugger because then we can walk through each piece step by step. Oh, I already hit a breakpoint. Sorry about that. So let's just go by stats. That's not interesting. So here we are. I'm going to update my primary tile. So another breakpoint. So when I update my primary tile here, what's happening is I go and I'm running this update click event. And you'll see here this tile helper. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I'm basically just sending it all the parameters that I want to use to populate this tile. This is an iconic template. I'm using an iconic template as my primary tile. You can use any of the templates as your primary tile. I'm sending it this information I'm going to have up here in the tile. I'm getting some images. Setting the color. That's a new thing now. You can set the color on the background of the iconic template. Previously on other tiles, you were stuck with the theme that the user had picked. Now what you could do, of course, is use a full bleed image to cover that up. But we think that, based on a lot of feedback, people care about brand and color can be a big part of that. So it may be that you want to set color as part of your brand. And then we're doing an update here. And I'm going through this tile helper. You'll see here's where actually that operation is taking place. And if I go back to my home screen now, you'll see it's updated with the iconic template. And you saw it had the animation. The title has changed. And the icon, the number has changed. And it did a little bit of an animated count up there. So let's go back in here and look at some of these other options. got to get rid of some of these. In the interest of time, I'm going to actually do some of this without debugging, because I think the first one sort of illustrated how this works in terms of the parameters. If you have more questions, let me know. There's a lot of stuff to show you guys today. In terms of iconic template, that's the same as the one we just looked at, because this primary tile is using an iconic template. Flip, here's the flip template. I'll create a flip template, and it created this icon on the right-hand side here with a beautiful image that we include in the Zap, the title, and then the back. And you'll see here, if I go and change this, the small is just a static image, but the wide is using a different image altogether. And that's basically how flip works now. And if I come through here, if I want to look at cycle, the cycle tile, again, this is using the 9 large images that are local. Small is using a static image again, but so it's really think people are going to be focused on the wide and the medium size. And if you look here, it'll cycle down to the next image. It does a bit of a pan, and that pan is going to, it's adjusted based on whether or not it's a medium size or a wide size, and to make it look a little less jarring. So what does this mean for an existing application? I think that's really sort of the next question. You automatically get a, let's go back here. Seven five apps automatically get the small size for free. When a 7.5 app runs on an 8.0 device, users will be able to make a small version of your tile with no work at all. That medium asset gets scaled down to the right size. But you get the ability to light up new features. So if you want to continue to ship and work on a Windows Phone 7 app, compiled as a Windows Phone 7 app, you can actually add tiles that take advantage of 8.0 features, and they will work when that application is run on an 8.0 device. With the primary tile, this is done using template 5, which is the standard tile. We convert that to a flip tile template when it runs on an 8.0 device. And then using reflection and detecting the version number, you just do conditional on the version number, then you can use reflection to actually set the values on the properties on the actual template. And I'll show you how that, what that looks like in a second. You also have to add another entry to the manifest. You get medium and wide tiles as well. And an important point here is that we really recommend you use WXGA assets. That's the largest resolution we support. We automatically scale those for all the other resolutions, but that's how you'll accomplish the best looking images. And you use shell tile uplate. This is just how you finish up on that. For second tiles, secondary tiles, like you can actually access all the new templates. It's only the primary one that will be limited to just the flip tile data. And there's also this great third party has already released a nice class library that will handle all the complexity of the reflection piece for you, because reflection is probably the hairiest part of this. But it's actually not that hairy. It's a little bit complicated, but once you look at it, it's not. It's just a question of using reflection to find the appropriate values. And here's what it looks like. In the manifest file, you'll see this is a 7.0 app, and I can tell that because app platform version is 7.1. I've added this bit here, app extra. And I'm just adding an app extra that will be applied when app version is 8, and it's the tile extra. And we've got this is just the ID for the product. This is the actual app entry. Now, if you then look, let's take a look at what this looks like, this application. This is a little sample application that leverages LightUp, and there's some other debug features in here. But what I can do, let me pin that tile. This is that 7.0 application again. And Let's remove some of these. So this application here is going to enable me to leverage, change my tiles based on reflection to actually leverage the new features. If I use Light Up My Life, it will change this to be an 8.0 tile, 8.0 compatible tile now. And I come over here and you'll see it's changed to use the flip tile properties. And I now also support wide. And I'll show you what that looks like in here. You'll see in the main page, we just are doing a check here to see what version we're on. And so this is assigning a value to this variable about what version. And, you know, here we've got a Boolean saying, are we on Apollo or not? Apollo was the code name for Windows Phone 8. We don't usually use that very much. And this is actually where it's checking with this return environment OS version. Now, once that's been done, there's some other stuff going on here. Sorry about that. So the actual work then is getting done down here. Let's find the reflection piece. Here it is. So here is where we're actually going to update the flip tile, and based on that click, we actually are sending this helper function to get the information, get the values that we're going to populate it with, and then this is where we get into the reflection piece. So if it's Apollo, we're going to go through here and set these properties. We're using reflection. You'll see that's this get type. And so it's basically spelunking this assembly to find this class and say, you know, what are all the types that are available? And then we come back here and we set those properties. And this is all done conditionally based on if it's Apollo or not. And that's all you have to do. And that gives you the primary tile that leverages the Apollo features. Now we can also go here and look at the secondary. There's a flip tile. These are secondary tiles. If I wanted to add an iconic tile, I can do that. And you'll see here is now an iconic tile. So this is a Windows Phone 7.5 application that's been updated to leverage these new parameters and create new templates, new tile templates. And so we think this is a great way for people to really start playing around with this new feature and functionality in their application without necessarily moving to building a Windows Phone 8 app. Okay. The next big thing I want to talk about is the lock screen. Before the user even looks at the start screen, they're looking at the lock screen. And so we've added the ability for you as a third-party developer to control both the notifications on the lock screen as well as the wallpaper image in the background. So, you know, this is pretty darn cool because this is a very, very high profile place. You'll see here's a picture of what that would look like with this, and I actually have this on the app. We'll look at it in a second. There's two things going on here. One is that we're updating that block of text on the lock screen where you'll see calendar appointments there. The user can control that now and put anything else there. If an application provides this functionality, it shows up in a new control panel called the lock screen settings. So there's a little bit of interaction here with the control panel. We give you as a developer the ability to interact with that as well. On the bottom right, you'll notice a new notification icon with a number. And that's another way that you can update information. If you have a numerical value that you can update, you can actually leverage that, become a provider for that area. And then the third one is the wallpaper. This is the detailed status and the quick status, we call those. This information is driven by the primary tile. But the primary tile doesn't even have to be pinned to start, it will still work. and you declare these values in the manifest. Lock screen background is the second piece here that I was talking about. You can update the wallpaper in the background. You can do it on a 30-minute interval, the minimum period of time you can do this. And you can, you know, basically define your application as a lock screen wallpaper provider and prompt the user to change that setting. And from there, you'll then be able to update the wallpaper directly. And we suspect you'll use, so these are local images again, so you'll want to use a background agent to update these locally on the device. And again, WXGA images are the default that you would want to provide here. You don't have to, but we suggest that that's the type of image you want to provide. So let's take a look at what this looks like. There were a couple other things I didn't show you that really, you know, in the manifest. So this is the WMApp manifest file, which you may be familiar with. It's under properties, WMApp, and a lot of values are stored here. And in Windows Phone 8, we've added a new graphical editor. Where you just double click, you get this graphical editor. And this is where you can actually specify the template for the primary tile. You could do it here, and then you can also add the images, the different image assets here. Once they're in your project, you can then add them there. You also can adjust capabilities, requirements, and et cetera. But it's often important to look at it in code because at that point, this is where you have to go to change extensions. So these are the extensions. There's three of them that are important. Lock screen notification icon count. This is the quick status. Text field, that's the detailed status, and then background. And so you add that value, and this GUID is always the same. You'll see it's the same for all three. But those are what you use to actually define and denote that your application can change the lock screen. And let's look at what this looks like in the application itself. So I'll pin this back here. And here's my application again. And you'll see, now I didn't talk about this. This is actually, you can launch the lock settings control panel directly from your app. And so it may be that you want to at some point prompt the user and say, hey, by the way, did you know I can control the lock screen? You could go set them from here. And so that's what this button does. Now I have a pivot here for lock that exercises all the features around lock. And this sample is going to be online in the next week or so. So you'll be able to see and walk through all of these examples in depth. But this is where we actually are showing the usage of these APIs in detail. Because one of the things you can do is you could actually just throw a dialogue up and say, do you want to set as lock screen? And with this, using this as a standard dialogue that comes out of the operating system, using this dialogue, you can actually avoid sending them to the control panel. Because we think lock screen is something people will really want to do, we actually added this in. And if I set yes, I can now actually lock the emulator. This is new in Windows Phone 8. You can lock the emulator with the F12 key. And you'll see it's updated the wallpaper now to be an image that I specified. Set here, this is allowing you to set the image. So this is actually going to launch. And so then that went to a breakpoint. Or no, I'm actually not debugging. So here we go. Okay, lock, pick. Now, pick is a way that you could actually, there's a method here that we use that you'll get in the sample code that shows you how to launch a photo chooser. And if I wanted to select this as my wallpaper, I could just do that. And just using that photo chooser, it set the wallpaper, and you'll see now that the wallpaper's changed to that. Reset takes you back to the default, and demo, and then the live lock. There's also a period, there's an agent included in the sample that will demonstrate how to use a periodic agent to refresh the image that you see there. And so it's interesting to look at how this is actually working. And the interaction with the settings control panel is the other interesting piece. It's kind of hard to find the settings control panel. The user has to go into settings, and there's lock screen here, and we've augmented this now to show you your any application that's installed that is a lock screen provider will appear here. So you can set it there. And we also give you the ability, this appears by default, this open app button, once you've set a third-party app as the lock screen provider, and this will send a parameter to your app as well. So you can respond appropriately when the user clicks on that button. So you'll see here I'm handling that parameter. It knows that I'm coming from the lock settings control panel, and when you get that parameter, what you'll want to do is open up the part of your application that has to do with the dynamic lock screen. So here we automatically move the application to the lock pivot because of that. So I'm going to take a few minutes and actually walk through a little bit more of the application here, because I realize I sort of glossed over some of that. There's actually quite a lot of functionality here. We've got examples around how to use C#, how to use XML, how to use local images, and how to use remote images as well. And so this is really interesting. And most of it works through this tile helper class here. What we've got here is a tile helper class that you send all the data and the information about the kind of tile that you want to build, and then it goes ahead and builds the tile and performs the operation. So you'll see here there's a class for cycle, flip, and iconic. And if I look at the iconic tile, for example, you'll see here it's receiving all these parameters, and then it's going and setting them right here. Now that's an example of doing it just using the properties. But if you want to see how it's done with XML, you can look down here, and it's conditionally going to be constructed with XML. That's when it then goes and does the tile action. And here, we're actually just performing these updates, shell tile create, and then it has to find the tile and do an update, or find the tile and do a delete. So those are the operations that are taking place there in this tile helper class. And of course, you'll be able to use all of this sample code however you'd like in your own applications. So how did we do? There's no more endpoint limit on push notifications. We actually addressed that concern. We've got the three new live tile templates, small, medium, and wide, and a consistent set of APIs now. It's very easy to handle multiple resolutions because we've chosen resolutions that are compatible with each other. If you give us WXGA assets, because we are leveraging the same aspect ratio on all three of our supported resolutions, we can scale those down and you get the highest quality images. We've also provided you the ability to leverage live tiles in your own application, in your existing 7X applications, through reflection. And really what this represents is us trying to give you all of the features and functionality that we leverage in our own applications. So these templates are not they're not additional templates on top of the operating system. They're the exact same templates that we use for ours. The iconic template is the same template that we use for our mail application. The cycle template is the same template that we use for our photos application. So there's actually another thing I wanted to mention. We've removed a limit on background agent execution. We used to, if an application hadn't run in 2 weeks, we would terminate the background agent because we were anticipating there were certain trade-offs being made. This all gets down to us trying to protect the end user experience. And background agents use resources of the device. And so we were making the call that if a user hadn't run an application within a two-week period, we could terminate the background agent. Well, what we're doing here is we're actually removing that limit if the tile is pinned to start or being used for the lock screen. So that means, because we're anticipating here that people, there's a use case where people install an application they just want it to update the tile, say it's the weather, and they don't ever go into the application. And so you don't want that background agent to stop. And so if your application is leveraging tiles or lock, we will not kill the background process anymore. And that went a lot faster than I thought it would. Do you have? I'd love to entertain your questions about tiles or lock, or show you some more of this in the time that we have left. Any questions? Yes. So the question was: is it still possible one? So I believe you're asking about the detailed status block. Is that you can only have one detailed status block? That's right. We only have room for one detailed status block on the home screen. The user gets to pick what that is. An application can prompt the user that it provides that, and they can set it, but that would replace the one that's being used. I didn't actually show you, and maybe I should just show you this, because one thing I didn't show is the quick status and the way that works, because not only do we provide you, let's go into, and we'll go to the settings here. If you go down here, so this is settings control panel, has some other information, and here's where notifications are set. You can actually pick the application that shows detailed status here, and you'll notice because I use that manifest value, my application now shows here, and the user can change to my application. These icons here are the quick status, and the location corresponds to where that will show on the lock screen. So if I don't want messaging on my lock screen or phone, if I don't want anything, I can just say none. Or if I just want my application over here in the lower right, I can do that here too, and say I want to have phone right next to it. And then when I lock the phone, and the issue is I haven't refreshed the tile. That's why you're not seeing it there. So if I go into the application and do a refresh, that's a reset, refresh. That didn't do it. Let's go here. Let's make sure. Open app. Okay, not sure what I'm doing wrong there. But basically, the settings control panel now allows the user full control over this quick status piece and what appears where. Can you say that again? You can no longer use, now are you talking about the quick status or the detailed status, or both? There's two. There's the block of text is the detail. If you change, you can only have one there, that's right. And if you change that, and both the quick and the detailed status have to be changed at the settings control panel. But you can prompt the user about it, like I said, and take them to the actual control panel. The wallpaper, you don't have to go to the control panel. You can programmatically throw the dialog box, and the user can say, yes, I want to be a wallpaper provider, and then we will set it for you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.